Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 21st of April. Very nice to have you with us on this eve of Earth Day. Let me introduce the panel and our special guest, and then we will get started. We also welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hi, Joseph, and I'm doing fine. I just want to tell you that when I hear that music, I just want to get my ice skates on and get down to the Trump rink in Central Park.
The Woolman rink. Go ahead. Yes.
No, it used to be Woolman. Now yeah. I think it's Trump. I think he did something there.
Co-opted. Well, good morning. Welcome. Rosemary Armeo is with us, director of the UAlbany Journalism Program. Good morning.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you here. And we are thrilled and delighted to have a very special guest and a dear friend to this radio station and to this program. Former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck is with us. Good morning, Judith.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Oh, it is so great to have you here. We're glad you're doing commentary. We, quite frankly, we're just glad that you're freed. we wish you were still in that job. God knows. We wish you were still in that job.
That would have been hard, me and the Trump administration.
I know
not
that.
Perfect.
Well,
not a good match.
I didn't say I wanted you in the Trump administration.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. I'm slow this morning. I'm following it.
But anyway, so good morning and welcome again. The letters panel at WAMC.org. We are going to go really earth heavy this morning because we have Judith here, and it's Earth Day, and we have a lot to discuss and a lot of climate matters. And we will certainly talk about other news of the day as we wind our way through our 90 minutes together. But let us begin with the current state of the EPA. So you leave January 20th, and I remember talking to you beforehand. I mean, in some ways, you know, you see what's coming, obviously.
Yes.
You get some clue.
Yeah.
But between now, as we look at these first 100 days, which will be marked next week, did you have any idea that the EPA would be in the position now that it was when you left?
Yes.
When you left?
I'm afraid I did. I had no inside information, but I followed the campaign closely. And I knew that Trump and Bannon would go right after the EPA budget, and they did it on cue. There's a proposed 31% budget cut, which is phenomenal. I knew there would be bad appointees, but not this bad. I mean, you can't find anyone in this cabinet who is an environmental champion. And look, I think Ivanka Trump is probably a successful businesswoman and fashion designer, and I typically don't like to pick on women in government. But if the fate of the climate change issue rests on Ivanka and Jared, that's really concerning me, especially when we've got great scientists all over the federal government who are now not going to be funded on the climate issue. You know, I left on Inauguration Day. I was, as a political appointee of President Obama, expected to step down. And even if Hillary won, I was planning on leaving. I did leave the EPA office with a box in hand and went to Trump Tower for a protest because I had to get right on the street. And it was kind of surreal being in a protest with my little box with a plant and my coffee mug in it. I knew it would be bad, and it's heartbreaking to see what is being proposed, not just for my former colleagues, but for the fate of the planet.
So I want to zoom in, and we'll talk about some larger issues here, and I know everybody else has questions for you too. But when you look at your job as regional administrator for the second region, what's happening right now? Like, who is doing what you did, mm-hmm. and how are their hands tied? Because it seems to me, and this is from an outsider looking in, that there really is no equivalent, really, to what you were doing.
Well, what typically happens is the career staff person, the deputy regional administrator, steps up to be the acting regional administrator. And so EPA Region 2 is in good hands right now. A very good woman, Catherine McCabe, who's actually grew up in Albany, is the acting regional administrator. She'll be replaced by the end of the year by a political appointee. who I suspect will not be very strong on environmental protection. So the career folks that are serving in these leadership positions are kind of caretakers, but the Scott Pruitt administration, Pruitt being the new head of the EPA, is putting a lot of handcuffs on the career staff. For instance, you may have noticed there's hardly any press releases coming out of EPA these days. I used to have my schedule posted on our webpage so everyone knew who I was meeting with. That no longer happens. I've heard from some national reporters that they're just trying to track down Scott Pruitt's schedule, because if you look at his media, it seems like he's mostly meeting with just the coal industry or the chemical industry. So reporters want to find out what's going on with him. There's a complete lack of transparency. I talk to former colleagues, not on business, they're just kind of grief counseling role. And they do tell me that it's hard to get anything moving, even simple letters don't get out the door. Everything has to be reviewed by Washington. And the Pruitt political appointees are mostly former staffers of Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma. I've testified before Senator Inhofe in the Congress. And let's just say
he's a climate denier. Yes,
he is the number one climate denier in Congress, also from Oklahoma with Scott Pruitt. And protecting the earth and protecting public health is nowhere on his radar.
Wow.
Alan,
I just don't know how we got here. It is so depressing. It is so distressing. It is so awful. We are talking, and I've said it 1,000 times, don't these people have any grandchildren? I mean, do they really? Is it really a matter of that they're prisoners of political ideology, which makes them do what they're doing and encourages them to encourage others to do this? It's just so depressing, Judith. I don't know how you stand it, because you know so much more than I do.
Well, I don't know about that, but the more you know, the harder it is. When I was leaving EPA, one of my partners in government, a commissioner in New York City, said to me, "Gosh, how are you doing? Like, personally, how are you? You must feel like you're leaving your children with axe murderers."
Exactly.
And that was kind of true. So it is disturbing. But look, the EPA staff are smart. They're resilient. My goodbye speech to them, I said, "You are the firewall. You can fight internally. If you're ever asked to do anything that is going to compromise public health, you fight like hell." And let's face it, it's kind of impossible to get fired from the federal government. So it's not that high risk. You do get marginalized, but you can keep your job. And we need the EPA staff to be strong. And I care very much about my former colleagues who I admire greatly, but the bigger issue is Americans will be drinking dirtier water and dirtier air because of the Trump administration.
That's my question. Can you tell us the worst case scenario? If Trump were to succeed the way he wants to and essentially kneecap the EPA and pull out of the Paris Accords, all of the things he's promised, bring back coal, although I don't know how he does that economically, what's the impact on America and on the world?
Well, I think on the climate change issue, which is most urgent, we can't afford to have the United States not just sitting on the sidelines for 4 years, but also aggressively promoting domestic oil, gas, and coal, including on public lands. I'm most concerned about the climate impacts. And even if we stay in Paris Accord, the UN agreement with 195 countries to reduce carbon pollution, that's at this point, it's almost symbolic, because the way the United States was going to achieve the emission reductions was through implementation of EPA's Clean Power Plan regulations, right? First in the nation regs to reduce carbon pollution. Trump's getting rid of that. He is getting rid of every single climate change program, including climate research, not just at EPA, but also at NOAA, at the military. The head of the OMB, Mr. Mulvaney, when asked about cutting climate change research dollars, he said, quote, "We're not spending money on that anymore. We consider that to be a waste of your money."
Oh my gosh.
That's a chapter in a book, if not an entire book. That will, when this guy leaves the world, that quote needs to be noted because it is so wildly irresponsible.
Which raises a question to me, Judith, and that is, we know that on some issues, Americans are really concerned. And I know an awful lot of people who think that this is at the top of their list. But the question is, how many do you really think? Because if Americans were really energized over this issue, Trump, because he's the ultimate opportunist, obviously, who has been known to change on a dime, would change. What is there any indication that there is that energy there?
Yes. I mean, I think our only hope are average citizens getting involved and getting politically active. You know, what's some of my EPA colleagues said, oh, we went through this during the Reagan administration. But remember, during the Reagan administration with Ann Gorsuch Burford, the mom of the new Supreme Court justice, when she was heading the EPA and her deputies going to jail over wrongdoing in office, we had a very active Democratic majority Congress. We don't have that this time. So, you know, typically I would say, you know, Congress needs to step in and we all need to push Congress. I don't have high hopes for that. So we're like at a different level, which is grassroots opposition. And so, you know, tomorrow is the big science march. The April 29th is the People's Climate March, which happens to be on President Trump's 100-day anniversary. And Alan, I think you're right. Trump seems to care about ratings. But the challenge with environmental issues is it always polls really well. And it's always like in people's top five issues. But are they energized enough to really put a lot of time and energy into pushing back? You know, so far, it's I'd say it's been a moderate level of pushback, but it has to get much more intense.
Why do you think the environment figured so? It didn't figure at all in the 2016 election. How did immigration become the top issue and not climate change or the environment?
Well, not to blame you guys, but the the media last year, national news coverage, I think on the cable shows, dedicated a total of 1 hour to climate change issues. And so I think, you know, if the media is educating the public pays more attention and then the public will take some action. And let's face it, climate change for some people is a little complicated. You know, they zone out in science class. And I also think there's kind of a psychological effect of not wanting to recognize really bad news. And unfortunately, this is really bad news.
Well, I'm sorry, I just have a small follow-up. One of the things I track on this is making a compelling argument. The media jumps on things that are good stories. And even now, you, as passionate as you are talking about the climate, used words like implementing and impacts. I want to know what the earth is going to look like in 4 years if Donald Trump gets his way. Will the skies be darker? Will children be dying of lead poisoning? I mean, you need concrete things. That's why the media can't grab onto this story, I think.
Right. I guess I'm a recovering federal bureaucrat. And the thing with climate is it's the author James Kunstler had a book, The Long Emergency. This is not like the immigration ban. You know, I'm spending the semester at Haub Law School at Pace University, and so impressed with the law students there. And I often say to them, for immigration law, when the president attempted the Muslim ban, and that's exactly what it is intended to be, you had lawyers racing to the airport with their laptops. It was mostly women lawyers in their 30s, immigration lawyers, and then the ACLU, of course, went to court and got the TRO. What is that moment for environmental lawyers?
Good point.
And for drinking water, you can make the case, if you look at Flint, if you look at Hoosick Falls, those are immediate health risks. On climate change, you know, it's here. I think Hurricane Sandy, you can't say it was caused by climate change, but it was far more intense because the ocean temperature was warmer that late October. But on climate change, it's, you know, you can't say tomorrow the skies are going to be dark. It means more heat death, less agricultural production, more Lyme disease, sea level rise. And we, including me, have to get a whole lot better on how to communicate this.
I have a quick follow-up, too, before we head to a break. And that is, you're talking about the employees and the career people there at the EPA who you believe can be a firewall. And yet we're reading these articles about how they're looking to shrink, that somehow this 15,000 employee workforce, they're looking to offer buyouts and get a lot of those people out of the way, right? These are the people who would be reduced.
Right.
So that's not really encouraging either then.
No. You know, during the Obama administration, which I loved, the EPA workforce went from 18,000 to 15,000. So, you know, it's not like they had a lot of extra people walking the halls. We were pretty stretched.
So what doesn't get done? I mean, if God forbid there's another case where you have a Hoosick Falls, mm-hmm. because that's in our region, and mm-hmm. you have something, how is that responded to?
Well, I think in the instance of Hoosick Falls, this new administration would not do what the Obama administration did, which is step in and exercise proper oversight over the New York State Health Department, who was not informing the public that they were drinking contaminated water in Hoosick Falls. We did enforcement cases getting PCB lighting out of public schools. We did a big air toxics case out in western New York where we cut benzene emissions from a facility by 90%. Those sort of cutting edge public health protections are not going to happen under this administration for two reasons. One is the staff will be significantly cut. They're looking at a 3,200 person reduction in staff. The early buyouts is a way to push people out the door earlier. My bigger concern, it's not the buyouts. We actually had one early out buyout when I was at EPA to slim the staff in 2014, you know, which wasn't great. I'm not so much as worried about the buyouts as I'm worried about what the final number is at the agency. And if you lose 3,200 people this year, you know, 2,000 people the following year, and 1,000 the following year, you essentially don't have a federal EPA left. And what you have is 50 different states, a race to the bottom. And, wow. You know, don't feel comforted thinking, well, we're in New York, it has progressive policies, because we've got lots of air pollution coming in from the Midwest. Our lungs will be impacted by Ohio policies.
Wow.
I'm going to pause you there. We're going to go to a break. We have a lot more to talk about. We'll continue. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, and our special guest, former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck, joins us, and currently teaching at Pace.
Elizabeth Haub Law School at Pace University.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So you were just telling us during the break, but you get to roam around and talk to the different classes and students about what it is that they should know.
Yeah, I'm free range at Haub Law School. I spoke in a class yesterday, administrative practice course. They wanted a lecture on how EPA really works. And I've done lectures on climate change and plastics in the ocean and drinking water. And I have to say, and I think our last segment probably sent everyone into a deep depression, and I apologize for that, but we need to know what we're dealing with here. But dealing with these high energy, smart Haub University law students is so encouraging. There's a lot of really smart young people going into environmental law.
Well, that is good news. We have some letters. Let's go to Michael's letter, who says, finally someone on the air to tell the truth. Ivanka, Jared are the face of this joke organization. Hopefully not too many Americans die because of Trump's big dumb mouth. Jim in Montgomery says, should the Democrats regain control of the White House, how long would it take to reverse the damage done by the Trump administration's executive orders affecting the EPA? That's a great question.
Yeah.
I had that on my list, too. Yeah.
Decades. I came into EPA after the administration of George W. Bush, and we did have to bring some smelling salts in with us. There are some people that just were not that engaged, and then there was a bunch of people who were ready to roll again. But what keeps me up at night is even if a Democrat wins in 4 years, if this pace keeps up, I think it'll take a tremendous amount of time and resources to rebuild the EPA.
We got this from Zach, who says, "Hi, panel. I was wondering if the panel could comment on the all-of-the-above philosophy the Obama administration took on energy. The Trump administration is an environmental disaster, but it seemed to me that President Obama's insistence on natural gas extraction was also taking us down a bad path."
Yeah, I agree. But wouldn't that be a nice debate to have? You could actually have substantive debates. And while President Obama did support fracking, it didn't happen in New York because of Governor Cuomo's policy. There was an attempt to regulate methane from fracking and deal with the water pollution issues. It all seems rather quaint considering what we're facing today. But I don't agree with all of the above energy policy. I think that was a mistake, but you know, that was the president's prerogative.
We got this letter from Barry, who says, "Please have Judith speak about what the change to the Clean Water Act definition of waters of the United States will mean to the protection of wetlands."
Not good. There's been this very complicated legal case making its way through the courts on EPA's authority to protect wetlands. And wetlands are more important than ever before because they serve as sponges and they help prevent flooding. Because of climate change, we're having more intense rainstorms over shorter periods of time. I think everyone recognizes that. So
I don't think some Republicans do in Congress, actually. They don't see any connection.
That's true. There is the problem of it's these two buildings on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington that doesn't seem to grasp science. But most Americans, I think, recognize that flooding is up and wetlands can absorb floodwaters and be an important habitat for fish and wildlife. So the Trump administration has a list of EPA regulations that they are obliterating, and waters of the United States designed to protect wetlands is one of them.
We had Neil deGrasse Tyson on.
You love him?
Yes. We had him on the show yesterday. And he said, you know, as long as we have, there are people in the administration who believe that the earth is flat. So if we start with that, that's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you said we were overly pessimistic in the first part of the show. But
I was.
But okay, well, I think, no, we're all in there with you. But how do we get out of just that? When you have people who not only, let's forget about climate change, but if we can't even come to an agreement that the earth is not flat, like, how does that work?
I have no idea.
Wow.
I mean, you can't really engage if people don't have a basic understanding.
What is the plus in having that philosophy for not only that individual, but for the administration as a whole?
Well, I think the environmental policies of the administration are dictated by tremendous hostility from Steve Bannon toward the EPA. And also, the real factor is special interest money, specifically the oil and gas industry. I mean, who would have predicted the head of ExxonMobil to head the Department of State? What I am following very, very closely is virtually all of these policies are dictated by promoting more domestic oil, gas, and coal production. Even something as simple as they're going to back off from better fuel efficiency standards for cars. Why would you do that? Because you want to sell more petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
The Trump administration has proposed getting rid of EPA's Energy Star program. When you buy a refrigerator or a computer, you look for the Energy Star logo to save money on your utility bill. They're getting rid of that. Why could that be? I think it's all about propping up the fossil fuel industry. Wow. And on the coal issue, I want to start with, I think, a mistake the Obama administration did when we rolled out very strong policies to reduce the use of coal. It wasn't a war on coal. It was a recognition that there are severe environmental impacts of coal burning. What we should have done is had equally high profile efforts looking at how to retrain coal miners and how to make sure their health care issues are taken care of, right, which is a big issue. You know, a week from today, the government may shut down. If Congress can't reach an agreement. And one of the issues that is really sticky is, do coal miners get generous pension benefits to take care of their health problems? And I think the fact that the Trump administration is not resolving that illustrates that they're for the coal companies, not the coal miners.
Alan, what do you make of the government shutdown? Do you think it'll happen?
Joe, I don't. On the other hand, the Democrats are taking an interesting tack here, and they are writing a whole bunch of prescriptions for not moving themselves and not helping the Republicans. I was very interested in something Judith had said a little earlier about the number of law students who are – now, this is Alan the cynic – the number of law students who are studying the environment and who are really, I'm sure, gung-ho to make a change. On the other hand, when they get out, Judith, you know who's doing the hiring and who
I
isn't.
I do. Yeah.
Go for the money, right?
Well, I don't think they have a choice. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've been dealing with lately who have done despicable things, really despicable things in their lifetime, and who say, hey, I got three kids or two kids and a wife and I got to do, or a husband and I got to do this stuff. You know, forgive me because I've sinned. And then the colleges and universities in this country couldn't wait to set up environmental programs. Mm-hmm. And yet the real question is, what happens when they get out? And my absolute question for Judith, who I think is the best of the best of the best, is mobilization. How do we mobilize? You've got all the facts at your fingertips. I don't expect you to be the expert on this, but how do we get people to give a damn to the point where they will show up in the same way as they did for the women's marches earlier? It was unbelievable. And we don't see that, right?
Yeah. We need our own hats, that's for sure. We need some visibility. You know, I think when people feel that they and their families are directly threatened, they will get more active. And what I'm nervous about is, on so many environmental issues, it's death by a thousand cuts. But there is the Science March tomorrow. There are the People's Climate March next weekend, the 29th. I think there's going to be very big crowds there. And it was kind of interesting, the tax marches last weekend. Trump, of course, was bothered by that and tweeted a bunch of times about the tax marches. The marches tomorrow and next Saturday are going to be much bigger than that, I think. They're expecting well over 400,000 people in Washington for the People's Climate March on the 29th. I think that kind of mass mobilization is crucial. It's easier to do using social media than it was even 10 years ago. But what's really needed is the sustained follow-up, calling the members of Congress regularly, the town hall meetings. I'm very disappointed that my Congress member, John Faso, won't do in-person town hall meetings. Why do you run for Congress if you're not willing to face your constituents face-to-face? I know there was a town hall on TV, and that was great, but
would
most
you hold
people
meetings?
Couldn't get in. Every member of Congress needs to consistently hold town hall
meetings.
Don't you
think the Republicans are saying to him, you're new on the block, do what we say or you're going to get it? And he's towing the line.
Well, I'm sure they are, but he's only been in office for a few months. And if you're not willing to face your constituents when you're a brand new member of Congress, what are you going to be like in the future? And I think town hall meetings are not the only way to get information, but I think that is participation, that's democracy, and the people across the country deserve that interaction.
Have you considered going into the legislature?
You know you're on that list. People are after you, boy. They want you to run.
Yeah, I'm not.
How come?
I don't know. Let's move on.
Oh. No, we got a presser on this. We got to come back.
Okay. I do have a question.
No, I'm not planning on running for Congress. I'm not. I feel like I really know environmental issues and I want to stay active.
But you agree, you certainly understand that people are coming to you. I mean, that's true, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you can also understand that people are looking for somebody who not only has name recognition, but has, get this, Rosemary and Alan, experience
in
government that would be helpful.
I want every incumbent to be really good on the environment. So I would love to go back to the town hall meeting.
All right. So Alan.
She could do State Department work, too.
You had a follow-up. Go ahead.
I had a new question. I want to go back to something that Judith said before about when she was in charge. How they landed on the, on the question of Hoosick Falls, and doing something that the state hadn't done. So now we get into the question of federalism. Okay, mm-hmm. The feds aren't going to do it. The states have to do it. Why wasn't New York all over Hoosick Falls in the beginning? They certainly got religion a little later on, but in the beginning, as you properly put it, they weren't. The health department wasn't supervising the way they should have, and the health department works for the governor.
Well, I think Hoosick Falls is Exhibit A as to why you can't leave everything to the state. And the whole model of EPA is EPA does the federal regulations. We then delegate a lot of these programs to the states, but it's essential that you have EPA oversight.
Yes.
And it typically works out. You know, it's very diplomatic. You do a dance. You know, I had to convince the Christie administration, for instance, to be better on different environmental programs. That was a little challenging at times, but we often got to a good place. So it's that EPA oversight that's crucial in every single state, including New York and California. But, so we're not going to see that in the future.
Well, but I'm not arguing that with you. Of course you're right about that. No question. Nevertheless, that ain't happening. So now the states become, as we always used to say, the laboratories of democracy. They become much more important.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got to pick up the slack, right?
They do, but EPA is cutting funding to the states by 40%. So they have to pick up the slack with state money. Wow. And with and leadership. And what I always liked about being at the EPA is you don't get the political pressure that you got at the state level. And I think it was often helpful for state commissioners to say, yeah, I don't really want to do this, but EPA is making me do it. I'm concerned that we're going to lose that dynamic.
Is there any hope of private industry or civic society taking up the slack as government is downsized and we get out of the climate control and taking care of the environment? Is there any hope that, especially if there's public pressure, that companies will do this on their own, that we'll see changes brought about also for economics? There are jobs and money in solar, for example.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the renewable energy industry is really booming. I think it's going to be case by case. Some companies are already pointing in the right direction in terms of their investments in clean energy and less toxic products. But I think the bad actors, it's going to get worse with them because they know there's not going to be the environmental cop on the beat. And there are still a lot of bad actors out there. EPA spent a lot of time and resources bringing enforcement cases. I also think that, you know, the utility industry, they were gearing up for complying with EPA's Clean Power Plan, which meant new investments in energy efficiency and renewable. They've now been given the total opposite message.
And you think they'll take the easy way out? They won't continue because it is the right thing and because the public is demanding it? You don't see that happening?
They'll do whatever is in their economic interest. So as the price of solar comes down, as it is dramatically, you'll see more investment in solar. But what's also interesting is you see people taking personal control of some of these issues. Massachusetts, it's amazing, Alan, the number of homes and businesses with solar panels on their rooftops. And it's noticeable when you then drive into New York, not as much. But I think more and more people are saying, we can produce our own clean energy. Let's just get out of the whole utility sector, and that's typically good for clean energy.
By the way, Judith, there's a whole bunch of questions that come along with this, like how do we educate people? I mean, I have three times called asking people to come over and look for whether we can do solar panels on our house and being told no. It faces the wrong way, and there are trees the way. And,
too many trees.
Old house can't put the panels on the roof.
And I'm sure there's a way around all of that if we just considered. But then there's the whole question of NIMBY, and we're seeing it in Western Massachusetts all the time. Oh well, we believe in renewable energy, but we don't like the windmills. Mm-hmm. We don't want windmills up there. And isn't it unsightly to have all of these solar panels in lots? And we want to pass a I'm not talking we. I'm talking about whoever's saying this. We want to pass a Great Barrington bylaw, so you really have a hard time putting panels in your yard otherwise it'll be offensive. This is disturbing to me, very disturbing. Yeah.
Well, two things on that. Those anti-solar local ordinances mm-hmm. are sweeping the country. There are dozens and dozens of them adopted in upstate New York. And it's not happening organically. It's being pushed by the Koch brothers and fossil fuel companies, who I think are feeling threatened by the increase in solar. So there's that dynamic. But then, Alan, there is the other reality that some people don't want to look at wind turbines. They don't want to look at solar panels, which I find a little bizarre. And I think in those situations, you just really have to engage with people early and talk to them and try to convince them on the merits. Some people are never going to change their opinion. But, you know, my view is if you don't like looking at a wind turbine, you're really not going to like sea level rise or smokestacks or, 115 degrees in the summer.
I actually would like one of those in my backyard. I think it would be really cute, better than the pinwheels that just turn. I wanted to ask if you...
Can you hold that question?
Yes, I can. I will remember
it. Okay, great. We are 8 minutes late for a break.
Sorry.
So let's go do that, and we'll be right back after this. Okay, we are back with Alan Chartok, Rosemary Romeo, and our special guest, Judith Enck, former EPA regional administrator. And before we went to the break, Rosemary was ready to ask a question.
Yeah, I have a question. Now, Alan talked about how there are all these follow-up questions to what we've been talking about on new education. Part of that is the media, which has shrinking resources across the board and many issues to cover. You know, just covering Trump's tweet keeps a lot of people busy. But if you were the assignment editor at a newspaper or a big broadcast station, what would you assign your environmental reporter to look at? You just mentioned a whole story about plastics in the ocean, about an effort to pass anti-solar. Those are two stories right there. What else? Give us some ideas.
Yeah, so I would look at, there are so many local environmental stories. I would look at, where does your drinking water come from? You know, where does your solid waste go? What are the job creation possibilities if we really ramp up on recycling and composting? But more than anything, I would look at the local impacts on climate change. This is a huge economic issue, not just an environmental issue. I mean, many major newspapers used to have full-time environmental reporters. Very few anymore. We're lucky the Albany Times Union has a couple good ones, Brian Nearing, and then mm-hmm. Brendan Lyons, who deserves all the credit for breaking the Hoosick Falls story.
Right.
If not for Brendan Lyons, I'm not sure the people of Hoosick Falls would be drinking cleaner water today. So that really illustrates the importance of local media, but no shortage of stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but here's the deal. It seems to me that when you say to the parents in Hoosick Falls, your babies are going to get infected with this stuff or sick from this stuff, you've got a terrific story. But as you pointed out earlier in the program, there is a sort of gradualism. We know what is happening over the long run, but that doesn't seem to be as sexy or as important, Rosemary, I guess, is the mm-hmm. is the assignment editor issue, as the gradualism. Yeah, we know that already. But when you say your kid is going to die because he drink or might die or might get very sick because of this water, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Flint, Michigan drinking water, Hoosick Falls was dramatic. And in fact, babies did have their blood lead levels tested and the very high levels of PFOA in the blood, 13 times the national average for residents of Hoosick Falls. And we know that the PFOA causes things like kidney cancer, thyroid disease, testicular cancer, and other illnesses. By the way, Bennington College is having a two-day conference in early May on PFOA and PFOS and contaminants in drinking water. That should be really interesting because Bennington and southern Vermont also had these drinking water problems. But, you know, the issue of lead poisoning, you know, it's slow. And yet, if a child has lead poisoning, it takes a few IQ points off of them or can cause more severe neurological damage. It is the slow emergency, and I think that's why the assignment editor might not think this is breaking news.
It's the same problem for people covering famine, which could be prevented anywhere in the world if people acted early enough. But we need images of starving children, like you were saying, Alan. Your child will die before people act. It's not just the media. It's citizenry, which does not respond until we have an imminent crisis.
Right. I was reading. I know this is a little off the subject, Rosemary, and I do apologize, and I won't talk about you know what. nevertheless,
Fire Island's just going to be there's going to be flooded.
Nevertheless, I was reading because yesterday was some kind of anniversary for George Metesky. Now you probably didn't live through it, any of you, but George Metesky was known as the Mad Bomber, and he was leaving bombs everywhere on subways and trains, and you know he would cut out things in movie theaters and put the bomb in the seat and blow people up, and he was ticked off at Consolidated Edison for having fired him in the wrong way and not been fair. So I'm interested in whether or not, as these become more obvious, we are risking, I don't want to incentivize anybody here, but we are risking people who are going to say, okay, you killed my kid, now I'm going to kill you.
Can we hold on and you can provide an answer? We'll give a very, you know, in those reality shows where they'll say, well, and we'll find the results out right after this. I'm going to do that to you all. So hold that thought. Judith, our job during the break for all of us is to remember the question. And then we'll go with the answer.
How could we forget that one?
And we'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Romeo, I'm Joe Donahue, and Judith Henk is with us, our special guest. She is the former EPA regional administrator, and God, you've been a friend of this radio station. When I started, 23 years ago, and you were like one of the first people I called when you were an environmental advocate. So you,
a long time.
You've been doing this a long time.
It's great to be back. You know, I was out of the area for 7 years, and I listen to WNYC, and I love WAMC.
Well, we thank you for that.
And it's a good time, Joe, to remind everybody about the WAMC app, which you can get and listen to the infinitely preferable WAMC in New York City.
I just stepped in it, didn't
I? No, you're helping our cause. We appreciate it. You know, we have been talking over the last hour about all of the things that are wrong. So let us talk. I know you have some guidance for us on how people can have their voices heard and some things going on over the next couple of days and weeks where people can find out more and take action.
Yeah, I mean, we're in this for the long haul, and every so often you have to have a little fun while you're addressing these issues. So tomorrow is the Science March. There are 400 marches happening all over the country, and you don't have to be a scientist to participate. You just have to believe that science should be part of our political decision-making process. So the Science March is at the Empire State Plaza tomorrow, Saturday, April 22nd. Happy Earth Day. It starts at 1 o'clock. And if you are in Saratoga and want to save fossil fuels and stay local, there's a science march in Congress Park in Saratoga tomorrow at noon. So go to the Science March, and then you have a week to recover and go to the People's Climate March, which will be really interesting. That is April 29th. It also happens to fall on the 100 days of Trump's presidency. I think they picked that date for a reason.
Yeah, the first day and the last day of his administration will have been marked if this comes off by massive protest marches.
Yeah, very exciting. And I was at the People's Climate March in New York City a few years ago. I'm still inspired by that day. Mm-hmm. It was amazing, and it was people that you don't typically see at these marches. And that's my other pitch, is if you're going, call up friends and family and neighbors who typically don't go to marches, because it's not everyone does that. I'm kind of a social person. I like to go, but not everyone does. So grab people who wouldn't typically go, and then mark your calendar for April 29th for the People's Climate March. There are buses going to Washington from Albany. You can go to peoplesclimate.org to see if you can still get a seat on the bus. And if you can't, on April 29th, there are events in Hudson at noon, the wonderful walkway over the Hudson in Poughkeepsie at 1 o'clock, Crandall Park, Glens Falls at 10 a.m., and also an event at the Cherry Valley Old School in Cherry Valley in Otsego County. So lots of opportunities for people to plug in locally.
Obviously a highly organized campaign, probably by George Soros.
I think organized by ordinary citizens.
Let's go to some letters. Joanne says, can you please ask your guest how climate affects Lyme disease?
Sure. Yeah, good question. So warmer temperatures will result in more ticks, more deer ticks, and consequently, sadly, more Lyme disease. And I lived this with problems in Puerto Rico, which was part of my EPA region, major problems with Zika, dengue fever, chikungunya. So the warmer temperatures will result in more of those type of illnesses because you get more mosquitoes, you get more ticks. That's why climate change is a pretty serious health threat, along with heat death and heat stroke.
And that, Rosemary, is precisely what the assignment editor, I suspect, that you were talking about
before, needs
to be emphasizing. Hey, this is not just conceptual stuff.
Brings it right home. This is not impact, implementation, all those horrible in the future. Some suggest that. All the things that make science science, the careful unwillingness to stretch beyond the evidence, is what makes it really difficult to write about. It makes it bad journalism.
You know, we are lucky not only to have Judith join us on the show, but you are also doing commentary for us now. And your work this week, your commentary this week, I was really surprised and fascinated by your talk about acid rain. I mean, this is something that we sort of thought, that was 1970s, you know, and now here we are.
Yeah, it was because of strong implementation of the Clean Air Act and the amendments that George Herbert Walker Bush signed into law that EPA was able to drive down acid rain by 70%.
Now it'll go up again.
And now it'll go up again, and then it's coupled with climate change.
Yeah. Samantha writes, if there were any way to link climate change to male pattern baldness or erectile dysfunction, we might get a meaningful public response.
So wait, I didn't hear the second part
that
of that.
That was funny.
I didn't hear the second part of that. If there were any way to do what again, Joe? That's worth repeating.
If there were any way to link climate change to male pattern baldness or erectile dysfunction, we might get a meaningful public response.
Well, Judith, do you have any advice for us on that one? I mean, is there
any connections we should know about for that assignment?
Nope.
All right, moving on. Joseph writes, I'm thinking that Pruitt will also move to gut the process of environmental impact statements and approve everything. Beware when a real estate guy talks about draining the swamp.
Already started. Yes, they're doing that.
Christopher says, what should environmentally minded college students strive to become in the next 5 to 10 years? What will be most needed after this administration has run its course? Oh, that's good.
Lawyers and scientists. In the short term, lawyers, because they've got a race to court to try to block these Trump regulations and executive orders. And then we need new scientists to encourage the existing scientists to keep at it, use some new technologies. But I think those are the two fields. And of course, journalists, because if you don't have a well-informed citizenry, there's no way to keep the public well informed. So I want to put in a big pitch for going to journalism school, as my son recently did.
But there's got to be an economic model, right? In other words, not-for-profits that are going to take this on so that the big boys and girls don't own it all and don't say, if you want to make a living, we're the only way to go here. I see that as becoming extraordinarily important. Now, we have some very important ones, but more are needed.
We got Deborah's letters, and I think it would be better to focus on the effect of the increases in pollution now, which is easier to track and to agree on, and less on climate change, which seems far off and is controversial. Citizen science, wonderfully described in a recent PBS program, should be revved up to provide real data and engage people socially and politically at the same time. This is all so discouraging, so we have to reframe the discussion and do something, which I think has been what you've been saying.
Oh, yeah. In citizen science, we really prioritized that during the Obama administration, and I think that's something that can take off even without the support of EPA.
So one of my questions, and I'll get back to the letters in a second, is, you know, we talk about how I think of this as triage. Mm-hmm. So there's the environmental triage of what do we look at first, because there's a million spinning plates. But then zoom out and you have Syria and you have healthcare and you have immigration.
War with North Korea.
And you have North mm-hmm. Korea. Mm-hmm. And, oh, by the way, our election may have been hacked by the Russians. How do we put all of this into a context and say, because we have to be, I mean, basically, anyone, we had Malcolm Nance talking about this, telling people that they had to be vigilant. So you got to be vigilant on everything, but we also hear from people who are in this day in, day out, like ourselves, who admit that there are times where you just have to take a step back because otherwise your brain will explode.
Yeah, and it's really hard to do in this era of social media. I mean, I'm kind of a case point. I wasn't supposed to do social media when I was at EPA. I mean, we had Twitter accounts and I wasn't supposed to be on Facebook because who knows what your odd uncle is going to post and then you would be associated with that. So I just kind of discovered Twitter in January. I'm at Ank J, by the way, and ENCKJ.
ENCKJ.
And I just think, in addition to WAMC, Twitter is a tremendous source of news. And so it comes at you 24/7. And some days I feel like I've got to just stop reading and carve out more time for doing, because you can spend your entire life just reading about the daily problems. And it's daily. I mean, what's coming at us every day sometimes used to be a news cycle, you know, over a month. But it is too much. And we also have to, you know, find a way to take care of ourselves and take care of each other during this very stressful time.
That was an interesting discussion over the break. We decided margaritas are not the way to go to relieve stress.
Got to think of another way other than drinking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I ask Judith about animals? We haven't talked about them. And that is an issue an object like children that people seem to care about. This administration is not friends to endangered species or baby animals either. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I would say the thing that's most under assault is the Endangered Species Act, including at the U.S. Department of Interior. And that is most unfortunate and an issue that we will regret for years and years and years. And kind of the classic story is a developer is trying to put something up and they discover something and, you know, who cares about the snail darter and who cares about, you know, the bald eagle, for instance. It's standing in the way of development. And so I think that statute is probably more at risk. And even if they don't change the statute, I think the federal agencies are being told not to be vigorous in the enforcement. So it's not just the species themselves that are at risk, but the number one reason for species extinction is loss of habitat. And so that wetland, that sensitive piece of land, if it happens to be where a developer wants to put something, that's going to be dicey. Oof. Thank you for raising that.
Yeah, koala bears are drinking water out of cups, which they don't normally do. You usually eat eucalyptus leaves. That got to me. Having read all of the stuff, it was a koala bear lapping out of a bowl that made me upset.
Alan?
And then there was there have been a couple of letters today which have basically said, because we have so many animals and meat and we're that kind of an industry, that contributes. We should have more vegetarians, they're saying, and less meat. What do you think about that?
That's absolutely true. I mean, meat production has severe environmental impacts. I occasionally eat meat. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. But I saw Leonardo DiCaprio's movie Before the Flood, which is fantastic. And one person on it said, you can't control what your member of Congress does. Maybe you can't control what companies do. But if there's one thing you can do in your own life to reduce the impact of climate change, it's stop eating meat. The data on that is very solid.
Andrew writes to us and says, it seems that the economy will always steal the spotlight, so any efforts to mitigate climate change will require an economic spin. Do you believe the economics of renewable energy will ever be politically accepted?
Yes. I think, you know, wind and solar and energy efficiency is making great progress. And the reason why I think we're making progress on renewables is not long ago. Pundits would say, oh, renewable energy is not realistic. It's just not going to be a big part of our energy portfolio. Now the question is, can you realistically get to 100% renewables? I love that debate. And there are 25 major cities around the country that have said they are committing to 100% renewables. So let's have that deep discussion and look at the economics of renewables and the air quality benefits of renewables. Mm-hmm.
Oleg says, I have become hopeful when I hear career staff can hold the line and provide resistance at the EPA. At the very least, we should have records documenting the greed, ignorance, and irresponsible acts by this administration against the environment and the citizens of this planet. They should be brought to justice in due time. So I guess the first thing you have to do is make it stop, and then you bring it to justice, right?
Yeah, and also, you know, career staff at any government agency, whether it's state, local, or federal, often get an unfair bad rap for not working hard, for not being innovative. I can tell you from my 7 years at EPA Region 2, there are a lot of very dedicated, hardworking people. And if they're in a meeting and they're told to do something that's not proper, we need them to speak up and say no, and don't let the problem get out of hand. So on a certain level, the people that are already inside the agencies are first line of defense, and they do have whistleblower protection. If they're being asked to do something that is illegal, they can be whistleblowers and have protection.
Were you mentioned earlier about a lot of this coming from Steve Bannon. If he were to leave the equation, as many have suggested that is possible, and some would even argue probable over the short term, would that change the dynamic at all?
I think it would in the White House, but then we're stuck with this cabinet. I mean, Scott Pruitt is the worst EPA administrator in the history of the agency. And I don't say that lightly. I say that based on his tenure as Oklahoma Attorney General, where he sued the EPA 14 times, his comments in his confirmation hearing. And just a few weeks ago, he actually said on national television that he's not convinced that humans are contributing to climate change. That is astonishing in this day and age. Let's have the Health and Human Service Secretary stand up and say tobacco doesn't cause lung cancer. That's the planetary equivalent of what Pruitt said. And then we've got Tillerson at State, and then we've got Rick Perry at Energy. Are you kidding me? Rick Perry at Energy, when he was a candidate, he said he wanted to abolish the Department of Energy.
Oh, he forgot he said it, but yes.
Oops. Whenever I tweet Rick Perry, I always attach oops. The guy at Interior is dreadful. Health and Human Services is not going to be focusing on the health impacts of pollution. So, you know, Bannon exiting, I think, would be a lovely thing for the entire world. But we still have the entire cabinet where, sadly, I can't point to one person who might raise their hand and say, Mr. President, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson and other scientists, 97% of scientists say climate change is real. It's caused by emissions from fossil fuel power plants, transportation, and deforestation. this is something we have to deal with.
You mentioned the world a moment ago. So let's, again, zoom out and how we fit in to the climate policies and the environmental policies of the rest of the world, and where we, because now people are, you know, pointing to China and saying,
yeah,
okay, well, they're the leaders now.
Yeah.
So how do we fit in? And if we give up and go this route, how devastating and how much of a domino effect does it have to the rest of the world?
Well, we are at risk. I mean, I think there has been a role reversal between China and the United States on climate change. And I mean, the environmental conditions in China are quite severe, particularly on air quality. But I think having the United States not supporting climate change research and regulatory action does not bode well on the world stage. So some nations that are on the fence are going to say, if the United States is not acknowledging the importance of climate change, we're not. And I just think this administration's position on climate change is an international embarrassment.
All right. Well, we're out of time.
I need a margarita.
Do you feel like you've been gutted with a steak knife? Well, at least Alan will be out in the garden. He'll be...
Yeah, no...
Happy Earth Day.
My thanks to Alan and to Rosemary, and of course to our special guest, Judith Enck. We can find you on Twitter.
Enck J, E-N-C-K-J. I love Twitter.
Excellent. And we look forward to following you and see what's going on. We're also going to get the information that you gave out about all of the events coming up, and we'll be able to pass that on to our listeners as well through our website, wamc.org/roundtable, and it'll be on the panel page when we get it up there. Give us a little while to do that, but it'll happen. And my thanks to everybody. Have a great weekend, and we'll meet back on Monday. Thank you very much.